40%. Shipments of cars to the European Union, heavily disrupted by global supply chain issues and by COVID, were down by a quarter. Guillermo Larbalestier, a trade economist at the University of Sussex, said the drop in vegetable exports was probably linked to a fall in the number of seasonal workers available to pick and process crops. More burdensome paperwork and the difficulty in exporting perishable goods in the face of extended delays at the border. Clothing exports have been affected because a high proportion of garments sold by UK retailers are made in Asia or the United States, making them ineligible for the tariffs negotiated in the post-Brexit trade deal. However, the latest figures do suggest a recovery from the worst of the Brexit damage seen in January of 2021, just after Britain's departure, when exports to the European Union plunged by as much as 40%. According to the latest figures, UK exports to the European Union were about £200 million higher in December of 2021 than the same month in 2018. But much of this was driven by an increase in wholesale gas prices on international energy markets. Business leaders have warned that border restrictions and reams of red tape have pushed up costs and added to delivery times, permanently undermining the competitiveness of British goods on the European continent. 67% of firms experienced a challenge when exporting and 72% when importing in the last month, according to the Office for National Statistics ONS surveys. There is a lot more friction on trade, which you would expect to have a more medium to long-term impact, said Grant Fitzner, chief economist at the Office for National Statistics. Meanwhile, Gareth Thomas, the Shadow International Trade Minister, said the government has exaggerated the benefits of trade deals with countries outside of the European Union that have yet to be negotiated. Ministers are not doing enough to support our exporters in markets outside of Europe, while the deal they negotiated with the European Union has led to long lorry queues into Dover, a big increase in red tape and a significant decline in trade, Gareth Thomas said. A UK government spokesperson said British goods exports to European Union nations were 4% higher last year compared with 2020. However, as the Office for National Statistics itself recognises, the impact of COVID-19 pandemic, global recession and supply chain disruption have caused higher levels of volatility in recent statistics. It is therefore still too early to draw any firm conclusions on the long-term impacts of our new trading relationship with the European Union. We are continuing to ensure that businesses get the support they need to trade effectively with Europe.
Iran is celebrating the 43rd anniversary of its Islamic Revolution. The uprising in 1979 is without question one of the most consequential events in modern political history. It not only changed Iran, but Iran's neighbors, the entire region, the whole planet. Iran's revolution, true popular uprising, it had one of the highest rates of participation in history, rivaling even the French Revolution, and continues to be a defining moment in world politics. Making it even more intriguing is not just how it affected Iran domestically, but equally Iran's immediate and distant neighbors. So what makes this revolution so substantial and so unique? How did Iran go from being a key U.S. ally to foe? What are the values of the revolution? What can we learn from them? And how does Iran's revolution translate into a powerful foreign policy which helps those struggling against imperialism and oppression? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. I think Iran is one of the most misunderstood countries in the Western world today. There's so much propaganda, Islamophobia, so many things that the media get wrong and which people end up internalizing. Most Americans probably only know one thing about the Iranian Revolution, which is the U.S. Embassy takeover. And even then, it's just stuff from movies like Argo or something. That's not enough. It's nowhere near enough. Iran's revolution is a much, much bigger issue than just that. The Islamic Revolution completely changed Iran's character and makeup as a country, and even the region itself. We're talking about such a seismic shift that we're still living through the effects of this revolution to this day. Now, most of the time, people tend to look at a revolution by analyzing it from a domestic point of view, by looking at it internally. But Iran's revolution is much bigger than that. It has far-reaching effects that go well beyond its borders. This popular uprising changed everything, from Iran's position as a key U.S. ally to the entire geopolitical makeup of the Middle East. It puts Iran at the center of international affairs. And it's very important for people to understand the mindset, the ideology, the values behind this revolution. A recurring theme that we see is the idea of oppressed versus oppressor. Iran's revolution is all about the downtrodden, the underdog, the oppressed rising up and vanquishing their oppressor. It's poetic justice in the form of an Islamic democratic republic. So let's go through a brief recap of Iran's history leading up to the revolution to understand the driving force behind the uprising in 1979. Now, this goes without saying, Iranians are a very proud people and their civilization dates back literally thousands and thousands of years. But if you look at Iran in the early 20th century, it was very different from how it looks today. Back then, Iran was ruled by the Qajar and then the Pahlavi dynasty. In 1908, oil was discovered in Iran. A British company called Burma Oil proceeded to create a subsidiary called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. This Anglo-Persian company installed its first pipeline in 1909, and it built an enormous refinery in Abadan, which was completed in 1912. This marked the beginning of the British plundering Iranian oil for the next decade. Now, you might know this company by its current name, British Petroleum, or BP. Now, at the time, Winston Churchill convinced the British government to buy an ownership share in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company in 1915, and he transitioned the Royal Navy's fleets from coal to petroleum. Iran was, of course, being taken advantage of. It was given crumbs by the British. Iran only received 16% of the revenue. Not only that, but this percentage was calculated in secret by the British, with the Iranians never being allowed to see the book. And to add insult to injury, this is after the British government had deducted tax paid to the British government. So it became very clear to Iranians they were being swindled and ripped off by the British. Now, after World War II, a man named Mohammad Mossadegh changed all of this. Mossadegh was appointed prime minister in 1951 after being elected by the Mejlis, Iran's parliament. Mossadegh was very popular among the people, and he proceeded to nationalize Iran's oil. This includes the oil refinery at Abadan, which, keep in mind, at the time, largest oil refinery in the world. The response to this by the British and the Americans was to stage a coup and get rid of Mossadegh. That's what usually happens when you nationalize your country's resources and refuse to hand them over to European colonial power. The operation to topple Mossadegh was called Operation Boot by the British. Meanwhile, the Americans, who were helping them in this endeavor, referred to it as Operation Ajax. The goal was to oust Mossadegh, reinstall the Shah, and retake the oil. And while people often attribute the coup of 1953 to the CIA, and that's partly true, the role of the British and British intelligence is equally important. Mossadegh's chief of police, for example, was kidnapped, tortured, and executed by Britain's foreign intelligence, MI6. Now, once the coup was over and they had gotten rid of Mossadegh, the British and the Americans moved quickly to help the Shah establish and train the SAVAK, Iran's secret police. The SAVAK were trained by the CIA. The CIA taught them how to repress dissidents, activists, and anyone who opposed the Shah. And this is remembered collectively in Iran as a period of immense struggle, a very dark period. And when the Shah reached power, he was very friendly toward West and Israel. For lack of a better term, he was a puppet. He was backed by the US, they sold him weapons, even passed a law stipulating that no US troops stationed in Iran could be prosecuted. He just gave them complete immunity. The United States sold more weapons to the Shah's Iran than any other country at the time, just to put that in perspective for you. While many people in Iran were suffering, Shah was living a very lavish life, busy throwing around money. He spent exorbitant sums of money on one single party. He built a city in the ancient Persepolis, invited loads of foreign dignitaries, and housed them in custom-built luxury apartments. No one knows the real cost of the party. Estimates range from $17 million all the way to $100. And so this lavish lifestyle that the Shah was living while people were suffering in Iran, this repression of Savak by the secret police, and this selling out Iran to the Americans and the Europeans, all of this together contributed to widespread resentment of the Shah, and it fanned the flames of revolution. Protests and movements to oppose the Shah began to spring up in late 1977 and grew rapidly. So we're talking about a very, very broad coalition, and that's important to understand because that's what makes the revolution a popular uprising and something that truly comes from the people. It's believed that around 10% of Iranians were demonstrating against the Shah, which is, it's frankly incredible because usually it's nowhere near as much. So you see the plurality of the uprising by the Iranian people against the Western-backed monarchy. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians taking to the streets in mass protests. In an attempt to stop this, the Shah declared martial law, but once it became clear there was no way he could quell the uprising, he left on vacation, never to return. And so February 1st, 1979, Imam Khomeini, leader of the revolution, was finally able to return after being exiled by the Shah for 15 years. Literally, over a million people took to the streets in a show of support. Shortly after, an Islamic League was established, national referendum, and the adoption of a constitution, and this marked the beginning of a new era. One of the core principles of the Iranian revolution is the idea of oppressed versus oppressor, and this is not only important because it relates to the people overcoming the oppression of the Shah and colonial influence. This theme is also important because it's derived from religious contexts. So when we talk about the mustadafin, oppressed, and the mustakbirin, the oppressor, many Iranians look to the Battle of Karbala, where Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was martyred in Iraq in the 7th century. And so this is another reason why one of the Islamic Republic's core beliefs and the ideology of the revolution is rooted in resistance and defending the oppressed. And so this belief was then translated into Iranian foreign policy. So it wasn't just about fighting oppression at home in Iran, but also about helping others outside Iran to fight their oppressed as well. And this is why one of the most compelling aspects of the Iranian revolution is its effect on surrounding countries and even the world at large. Let's look at Lebanon, for example. In 1982, 3 years after the Iranian revolution, Israel invades Lebanon. And shortly afterwards, Hezbollah was created. Hezbollah is a Lebanese resistance group. It has both a political and a military wing. And it was created with the purpose of resisting Israel's illegal occupation of South Lebanon. Ultimately, the Israelis would be kicked out and forced to withdraw in the year 2000. And then Israel invaded Lebanon again in 2006. But this time the Israelis were met with a blistering military response, which caught them completely off guard. So where did Hezbollah come from? And why was it so successful in defeating Israelis and kicking them out of South Lebanon and liberating Lebanon? The answer is Iran. Iran helped Hezbollah take shape as an organization, helped grow, provided it with training, weapons, and tools to fight against the Israeli colonizers. Hezbollah has always said that its military victories and liberation of the South are not just for one group or one sect, but for all of Lebanon. And in 2006, the 33-day war was a huge, huge military victory for Hezbollah. Many of the new weapons and technology which they used were provided by Iran. Such was the shock that Israel has never bombed Lebanon since. Now, more recently, in 2021, we saw Hezbollah bringing in truckloads of fuel into Lebanon to mitigate the economic crisis and the de facto American siege. This fuel was distributed by Hezbollah to orphanages, hospitals, and those who are most in need, completely free of charge. Who provided this fuel? Again, Iran. So yeah, this dynamic here of helping the oppressed overcome the oppressor, it extends far beyond Iran's borders. Let's look at Syria. Syria, where I was born, was in big trouble and about to fall to Daesh. Not just Daesh, but a lot of terrorist groups like Falaq al-Rahman, Jaish al-Islam, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, all of these funded by one country or another, the US, Saudi Arabia, and so on. And when Syria was just about to fall to these head-chopping maniacs, what did Iran do? Iran didn't just sit on the sidelines. It came to help Syria liberate itself from the onslaught of Fiery terrorists. It came to liberate Syria from Al-Qaeda and Daesh and these terrorists that were sent our way. Let's look at Palestine. Palestine, which has been under Israeli occupation since 1948. Who is defending Palestine? Look around you today. Where are the Saudis? Where are the Emiratis? Where are the Bahrainis? Where are the Arabs? Not the people, but the government. The governments, many of the Arab governments and heads of states, they have abandoned the Palestinians, and it is shameful. Iran is not even an Arab country, and Iran supports the Palestinian cause more than some Arab countries. Hamas, which is in power in the Gaza Strip since 2006, has enjoyed an extensive relationship with Iran, extensive support from Iran, and continues to enjoy that support to this day. Let's look at Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Look at how many weapons the Saudis have bought. $115 billion worth of weapons from Obama. $300 billion worth of weapons from Trump. Billions and billions they've spent on weapons to use against Yemen, to commit genocide against Yemen. Not one of these Western countries that talk about human rights has stood with Yemen. Where's the UK? Where's Canada? Where's France? Where's Germany? All of them profiting off of the war. How many of them are standing with, not just in saying, oh, the war is bad, genocide is bad, but actually standing with Yemen, supporting the Yemenis and their resistance? Very few. And Iran is one of them. Iran is one of the few actually standing behind the Houthis, behind Ansarullah. So you're starting to see the difference, aren't you? All of this support is rooted in the Iranian Revolution of 1979. You have a country, an Islamic Republic, that's standing up not just for itself, but also helping others to overcome their oppressors. Stay tuned, we'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now is John White, a Scotland-based writer and political commentator. He's written for numerous outlets, including Morning Star, The Huffington Post, The Independent, and The Foreign Policy Journal. Thank you so much for coming to the program. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I want to start out with a more general question about the Iranian Revolution before we get into specifics. Why do you think this is one of the most consequential events in modern political history?
It certainly changed the game in the Middle East and even beyond. And the evidence for that is the way that it still strikes terror in the hearts of Western ideologues with regards to their unrelenting attempts to roll it back with sanctions, with terror attacks, trying to isolate Iran, trying to marginalize Iran, trying to push back against Iran's influence. It was none other than Dostoevsky who once made the point that the best way to stop a prisoner from escaping is to make sure he never knows that he's in prison. And this is the way that elites govern in countries that govern in the interests of elites rather than the masses. And when the prisoners, i.e. the masses, wake up to the fact that they are in prison, that's when revolutions occur. And that's what happened in Iran in 1979 after decades of oppression under the Shah Ahmad Reza Pahlavi, a US placeman, a US agent. And it blew out of the water US grand strategy at the time under the Nixon doctrine, which was a twin pillar approach to dominating the Middle East through the process of applying government in Iran and applying government in Riyadh. And so it set back on its heels US Grand Statute Day. And the Iranian Revolution has caused a huge upheaval in capitals, not just in the region, but also, more importantly, in the West. So the Iranian Revolution has had many, many effects. Their alliance with Venezuela, with Cuba, they're linking up with Russia. It's been a major milestone on the way to a multipolar world. And I think its effects will be felt for many years to come.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting point. You touched on some of the things that I wanted to ask you about, which is, you know, people tend to analyze revolutions internally. But when we look at the Iranian revolution, it's had a lot of influence externally. You mentioned Venezuela, you mentioned Syria, you mentioned Lebanon and their resistance. Why do you think that this is something that's a product of the Iranian revolution? Is this something that's a core principle? It's something that they believe in to help the downtrodden, to people who are under occupation, even all the way inland?
The most special thing about the Iranian revolution is its own sectarian character. Because obviously Iran's a Shia country, a Shia-dominated country, that does not mean it articulates its politics on those terms. It articulates its stand in terms of the oppressed versus oppressor. And the Iranian governments, post-revolutionary governments, have stood firmly on the side of the oppressed, whether it's the Hamas in Palestine, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's Cuba, whether it's the Irish Republican movement, whether it's the Syrian Arab Republic in terms of the onslaught that it faced from the tidal wave of Salafi jihadi counter-revolutionary forces on the back of the Iraq war and occupation by the US and its allies. So it's non-sectarian character which makes it so, so special, because a revolution has by definition to be non-sectarian because it has to be on the side of the oppressed. And that's what the Iranian revolution has stood for. And by the way, it's came at a heavy price for the Iranians. I mean, the kind of resources that they've extended to help the Lebanese people struggle against Israeli aggression, to the Syrian Arab Republic, to Venezuela, etc., etc., it's come at a heavy, heavy price. And that speaks to the level of political consciousness that lies at the heart of that revolution and its impulse around the world.
The way that the revolution is viewed around the world tends to differ, right? How do you think that the revolution is viewed by Iran's neighbors versus how Europe views the revolution, how the United States views it? It's quite a substantial difference, isn't it?
Indeed. I think the neighbours see it favourably, obviously, whether we're talking about the people of Yemen, the people of Syria, the people of Lebanon, the people of Palestine. But in the West, they've tried to paint Iran as some kind of dark Islamic hellhole, you know, and it's very Islamophobic. But this is the best tribute to Islam, the Iranian revolution, because, as I say, it's non-sectarian. It has allies who are non-Muslim, allies who are Sunni. It's on the side of anybody who happens to be oppressed, unequivocally. And so, yeah, there is this attempt in the West, and it succeeded, I hate to say it, because of all these think tanks and all the anti-Islamic press that obtains in the West, and painting it as some kind of reactionary development, and Iran is some kind of dark power. But in truth, Iran is a light, is one of the few lights in our world, along with China, along with Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, etc., against the dark powers of Western hegemony. And that's why they can't understand it. Iran's crime in state capitals in the West is that it doesn't bow. That's it. Despite all the bluster, despite propaganda, Iran refuses to bow to Western hegemony. And that's why it's so demonized and so attacked.
What do you think is one of the most misunderstood aspects of the Iranian revolution, not just in 1979, but, you know, all the way through to the present day?
Well, it was an emancipatory project. It has an Islamic, obviously, context, but in an emancipatory sense, because it understood that the masses are where the locus of power should reside, not with the elites, not the megalomania of a kind of obscene ostentation, with the humility that comes from Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, this man in exile in Paris, through cassette tape, was able to stir the man in Iran. He was the very epitome of the mantra of cometh the time, cometh the man. And so the Iranian revolution is a wonderful tribute to the possibility of a masses empowered by an ideology, Shia Islam, but it became a material force and it's adapted to the modern age. That's his beauty, and that's his enduring truth.
You know, under the Shah, Iran had ties with Israel, being that it was sort of, you know, a U.S.-U.K. And of course, that was flipped on its head by the revolution. Just very simply, is that one of the reasons that Israel and Iran are at such odds? Because they no longer have someone who can play the regional policeman for them.
Well, yeah, it's a matter of fact that after the Iranian Revolution, the US ploughed huge resources into bolstering Israel and obviously the Saudis. Don't forget, the Saudis, under King Faisal, in 1973, instituted the first oil shock, the embargo, over Yom Kippur War. That's when the Saudis were a government that was actually on the side of the Arabs rather than the side of the West. And since then, the American policy, the grand strategy has been to keep Saudi Arabia close and keep Israel even closer because it needs these two powers to try and maintain its fading domination in the region. Iran is a beacon of hope for the future. We have an arc of resistance, the axis of resistance, Syria, Lebanon and Iran, and it's grown ever, ever stronger. And I think it is coming soon when Iran will be hegemonic power in the region. Not hegemonic in a negative sense, but in a positive sense, on the side of peace and then on the side of stability and security for all.
And, just as a last question, if we can maybe go back a bit in time, the 1953 coup, when the US and UK, right, they took out the Iranian Prime Minister Mossadegh and they brought the Shah back to power. How instrumental do you think all of this was in molding Iran's future, the events that led up to the revolution, and the way that Iranians view the United States and the UK today?
I think that was a main driving force behind the revolution. I think that informed political consciousness among the masses. They understood what happened to Mossadegh. It was a great crime, it's a historical crime. And I think the revolution was in large part a revenge for that horrible crime against Mossadegh, a democratically elected leader whose only crime in the eyes of the West was to nationalise Iran's oil in the interest of its people rather than Western oil companies. So the Iranian revolution was given extra impetus on the back of that knowledge and that historical crime. And I think the Iranian people will never forget. And there's one thing, obviously I'm not getting into Iran's domestic situation because I don't live there and I don't feel I have the right to comment. I'm talking about foreign policy. But one thing that will unite the Iranian people is any attempt by the US or its allies or regional powers to try and interfere in Iran's domestic policy, domestic politics. And I think that despite the depredation of the sanctions, again, the most severe ever imposed on any country, the Iranian people are strong, united when it comes to understanding the role of the US in their history, the malign role of the US and its allies in their history, and they will never be quenched. They're just far too powerful, morally, spiritually, and materially.
Iran doesn't gain anything material from supporting Palestinians. It doesn't gain anything material from supporting Syria, especially when Syria is being demonized. It doesn't gain anything material from backing Venezuela or Cuba. If anything, it actually costs Iran money to stick its neck out like that to support Hezbollah. Because then Iran is subjected to more sanctions. They call Iran a state sponsor of terrorism. They vilify Iran in the press and so on. And you see, that's the difference here. That's the difference between Iran and the US. Because the US buddies up with countries in order to sell them weapons so the corporations and the arms dealers can make money, can rake in big profits. Iran is not interested in profits. It's interested in principles, in developing long-lasting, meaningful alliances and reaching out to the downtrodden, to people who are resisting oppression. The axis of resistance isn't just stronger today than ever before, thanks to Iran. It might not have even existed if it weren't for Iran. War hawk and neoconservative John Bolton once said that the Iranian revolution wouldn't get past its 40th anniversary. Well, look how that turned out. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The Islamic Revolution and its ideals are indeed undefeatable, no matter the gravity of the plots of the devilish powers, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Grand Display of People's Support in Revolution Rallies. Stay tuned for more. If rains and snowfall had not stopped millions of Iranians from marching on the streets every year on February 11th nationwide to celebrate the climax of the 10-day dawn that marks the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, their fervor of the past 2 years on this auspicious occasion to triumph over a pandemic that has paralyzed the world is indeed further proof of their indomitable spirit. This unassailable spirit, which for the past 43 years has weathered an 8-year war and defeated the unabated U.S. sanctions, economic terrorism, was on full display in Tehran and throughout the country as the nation marked yet another glorious anniversary of the emergence of Iran from decades of domestic despotism and foreign hegemony. In observance of the health and hygienic guidelines because of the coronavirus, in most towns and cities, it were rallies of cars and motorcycles as well as trucks, but this did not deter many to come out on foot, flashing victory gains, waving the national flag, holding posters of the father of the Islamic Revolution and of the present leader of the Islamic Revolution, along with those of martyr Qasem Soleimani. And of course, making a bonfire of the emblems of those two most hated symbols of oppression and terrorism, that is the U.S. and Zionist entity. The joyous mood of the million-strong Iranian masses is indeed a resounding slap on the face of the great Satan and its minions, whose intricate plots have been foiled time and again. In the capital, jubilant Iranians converged on Azadi Square from all directions to renew allegiance to the Islamic Republic system of government and its refusal to bow to blackmail. The communique read at the end of the rally emphasized Iran's independence and progress. It also called for the withdrawal of all CENTCOM terrorists from neighboring Iraq and the entire West Asia region, with expression of full support to the Palestinian struggle for liberation of their homeland, as well as for nations fighting invaders and terrorists. As testimony to the grassroots support of the Iranian people to the revolution, President Dr. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi, in his speech at the Friday prayer gathering at Tehran's sprawling Imam Khomeini Musalla, made it clear that the Islamic Republic counts on itself for its stability and progress, without any trust in talks and those who have a record of breaking promises. He said, "We have faith in God Almighty and full reliance on the people and resources of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan provinces, the east, west, and south of our country, but we never have expectations in the results of talks in Vienna or New York." This aptly sums up Iran's policy of balanced relations with the international community on the basis of reciprocal respect and firm opposition to the hegemons and their clients who destabilize regional peace and the world order. The Islamic Revolution and its ideals are indeed undefeatable, no matter the gravity of the plots of the devilish powers. Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we saw that more than 50 countries have depleted uranium weapons. These weapons have been used extensively by U.S. and NATO forces during the past three decades, namely in Iraq and the Balkans. The consequences for both military personnel and civilians have proven to be tragic. Yet despite the evidence, the military industry and nuclear authorities continue to downplay the dangers. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the program.
Our soldiers on peace missions in the Balkans are said to have been contaminated due to the presence of depleted uranium in the munitions.
My friends, we have with us Sergeant Major Antonacci. Unfortunately, you're ill. Could you tell us how this came about?
I left on August the 31st, 1998, for a six-month mission. I got the go-ahead after medical checks. During my stay in Sarajevo, I suffered several faint and dizzy spells. And a few months after I came back, these were attributed to lymphoma.
Cancer?
In Florence, I meet General Fabio Mini. In 2002, he takes command of the NATO mission in Kosovo. He's immediately concerned by the risks involved with depleted uranium, following NATO strikes in the area in 1999.
My chain of command, formed by an American admiral in Naples and the supreme Allied commander in Brussels, stood by the official directives and reports, including those drawn up by scientists in the U.S. I was therefore frequently confronted with this type of response. It's true, Fabio. You're right to be worried, but we have reports which say that there's no problem. And from a military point of view, we can't bypass them to do things that go beyond what is asked of us, and which could even prevent us from accomplishing our mission. So it was recommended that we reiterate and support among the civil population the fact that it wasn't a grave danger, that it was quite normal. And to say to the military, especially the engineer corps, treat the depleted uranium munitions like any other type of munitions. But a grenade is not the same thing as a depleted uranium projectile. I'll tell you something. In 2007, I was treated for a tumor in my colon. I never wondered if it was because of the year I spent in Kosovo. But I'll always have doubts. I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering, the pain, the injuries, deaths, and damage should never go beyond by even a millimeter what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia. A truck that was contaminated, claims Alain Acariès, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Mr. Acariès provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium, and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years, and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigolf, of which Alain Acariès is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Bertala Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alain Acariès is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attacked Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the U.S. despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
Mm-hmm. This, when I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely and before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he survives. If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we register, the incidence about 14.7 per thousand live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per thousand. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001. But he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from a strategic planning standpoint, why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great because it's really effective and it's recyclable too. I think in that situation, there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium-producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap when it gets there? When they bring it there, then they put it in the ground. What do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create, then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use